This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to No Lies Radio.
When we do it live, it goes in eternity.
Welcome to the special live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, going all out for truth since 2006. I'm broadcasting on No Lies Radio, Veterans Today Radio, and last but far from least, live right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the greatest of all our listener-supported networks. So be a listener supporter. Go to freedomslips.com, kick in what you can. And while you're at it, feel free to become a member over at truthjihad.com. For $3.95 a month, you get early access to my shows, including the pre-recorded ones, plus free downloads. Check it out, truthjihad.com. All right, tonight we're going to break a huge story. Well, not exactly break it, but I think Gordon Duff is the guy who's basically broken this story. And the story is the controlled demolition of America by way of the 11-9-9-11. That's right. No, I don't think it's an accident that our 11-9, you know, waking up on Wednesday morning and finding that Trump was president after a very, very strange kind of reversal of all of the polls. And now we know it was a very, very low voter turnout, much lower than it should have been. And the exit polls didn't match up with the reported so-called results, especially in the key swing states where we had Trump 5 points ahead of what the exit polls said he should have had, giving him victory, putting him in the White House. If I were a paranoid conspiracy theorist, I would think there was something really wrong with this whole scenario. What do you think, Gordon Duff?
We looked at the election count. It was announced on USA Today at 1 a.m. on Wednesday, and as an increase, and this is 2,300 counties, about 50% of the country, and a pretty average demographic, had us at a 4.7% increase over 2012. It's still a less, and 2012 was a smaller year. John McCain was a far more attractive nightmare candidate than Mitt Romney. Oh, and Mitt Romney, of course, pulled more votes than John McCain. And Donald Trump, by the way, also.
So Trump got fewer votes than Romney and McCain.
You got a couple of thousand more than McCain, but less than Romney. Mm-hmm. And Romney, of course, lost in a landslide. According to USA Today, meaning according to the Federal Election Commission, the number of votes that were cast were 135,740,000 was as close as they came. And of that 135, or almost 136 million, 120,000 were counted, leaving 10 million votes up to 16 million votes, simply as disappeared, 16 million votes.
And you're getting that number from the USA Today projections compared to the reported results.
It's not their projections. It's their reporting the actual vote counts.
Okay, so we've got different vote counts. We've got one set of...
Well, in this case, if it's a projection taken from a hard figure rather than just pulled out of someone's hind end, meaning that voting was listed as very brisk and up 4.7% by 1 in the morning. Now, these are by precinct. Most precincts in the U.S., all that reported in, averaged an increase of votes over 2012 of 4.7%. And when they were done, the number of votes that were counted were negative 4.7% instead of positive. So they went from reporting very brisk and an increase based on everything we knew. There was a full 10% or more difference between the votes that were counted for president and the votes that were, according to the precincts, actually cast. And almost immediately, all of this information just disappeared. Of course, I have it in the in VT, the specific quote. I guess you could read it if you want, but it states essentially that Trumka ended up getting 60 million votes or 59 million something. He just topped 60. The popular vote was won by Hillary Clinton, who won the popular vote. And the issue being that 129 million voters came to the polls in 2012. And according to the last results we got, only 120 million fewer voters came. And that that 2012 election was the snoozer of all time. I mean, Romney never stood a chance, simply walked away from the election. And
That is strange, because this election was on everybody's mind. And even though at first glance one might say, well, Hillary Clinton is such an unattractive candidate that tons and tons of Democrats and minorities and women, all those people that we kind of expected would vote for Hillary Clinton, they stayed home in record numbers just because they didn't like her. But, you know, if you think about it, Gordon, this was such a circus, and the negatives with Trump were so high that this is just implausible.
No, it's different than even that. The early voting was an all-time record. 41 million Americans voted early. Here in Toledo, we have one poll on, for early voting on Monroe Street near Cherry, in an area I would be hesitant to park my car. And lines were around the block on this every single day, to the point that I didn't early vote, and I really would have liked to. And all of the people in those lines were black.
Mm-hmm.
Day after, and sitting in that line, certainly more women than men on a 3-to-1 basis. But they were there. The African-American vote, the Latin vote, was off the scale, and none of their votes were counted.
So how was this done? This was done through control of the machinery.
This was done in a hack done between the FBI, the Mossad, but the hack itself was done run by the Russians. I can give you the history of this, and I will tell you, I talked this over today with the Russian Foreign Ministry, not asking them to admit it, but we went over the election, and I expressed my displeasure with them for their interference in the election. And here's kind of you and I talked earlier today, but I'll run this
scenario. Yeah, let's fill in the listeners.
Yeah. And I'm going to insult listeners here, just, you know, and you can excuse me or not, because, you know, I can give a shit.
Well, you know, Gordon, though, this is one of the problems with you in terms of running you for president. You have negatives that are almost one-third of Trump's because of this kind of insulting.
Apparently, I don't do enough wrong, you know. I'm a motorcycle riding, open carry guy with, you know, I've never carried the same gun twice, as a matter of fact. You know, he can tell you about that. I have more guns probably than Charlton Heston had.
Right. But, well, just don't insult your audience too much, or you'll end up having those negatives.
Oh, really? First, I want to thank, if anybody went out to the street here, if you guys went out in the street, if you're out there listening and you were in the street today, you have my thanks and admiration. Okay. To my extent, I went head to head with the FBI when I found them being paid off by the mob for their little games in the election. Head to head. And that was not at any small personal risk, and went much further than that. So I go full out on this based on simple right and wrong, because, you know, I'm a defense contractor. I'll tell you, the people around Clinton, and I talked to some of them, are total assholes. Jesus. I mean, they're, you know, hubris, idiots or whatever. And then you've got normally the Republicans, and the most despicable of them as far as politics goes, you know, the neocons, for all of this stuff about Trump and he's going to sweep the sewer clean. Well, all of the neocons, John Bolton, Rudy Giuliani, and the whole Bush gang are lined up, and they are all on his transition group. This is a pure neocon. And I'll give you one thing to just jump in early for these how promises work and how shallow and stupid some people are. I've worked with a coal lobby before. I was a lobbyist in Washington for some time. Among others, I represented General Motors. But I have been a D.C. lobbyist, worked in aerospace when General Motors had owned Hughes and had partnerships with AT&T in what was then American Mobile Satellite. But I work in satellite surveillance, satellite communication stuff, you know, and aerospace, and I sit on the board of a couple of those companies right now, and worked in public safety communications. I worked with FEMA early on when they were developing their first communication systems. And it put me in and out of Washington. And one of the guys with our lobbying group represented the coal lobby, and he was a former congressman, did some jail time. And that's kind of how this pretty much works.
It's a revolving door between Congress, the defense industry, and the jail cell, if you're unlucky.
The jail cell, pretty much. I could have asked twice as much money if I had some jail time. You know,
right. It's an experience for your resume.
Let's talk about climate science here. You know, the coal industry is the one that finances coal, and to a lesser extent nuclear, finance all of the climate denialism.
Yeah, that's what David Ray Griffin's book, Unprecedented, argues, and he backs it up with a fair amount of data.
I don't have to back it up. I mean, I eat lunch with these guys every day. You know, we had I like working in Washington to some degree. We had a little group with my buddy Larry, who is deputy director of the XXX. I can't say those letters anymore. And then the then director, which was a George something. And then a former director of the KGB who came to the U.S. But we used to have lunch at the Watergate together brunch, really.
That's an appropriate place to have lunch with the KGB.
It's a very nice Sunday brunch, but we did that for a number of years. But there are a group of us that worked together for some time. Some were FBI's counterterrorism hostage rescue. And then the Pentagon, Jim Hankey and his group at NATO Intelligence, and then us with, I can't say who that is, but we were all pretty good friends. You know, Kalugin is the guy I'm talking about, Oleg Kalugin. But all of the lobbyists kind of know each other. It's all kind of an inside thing, and there's no hard feelings between people. I mean, you know, John McCain, you know, and Bill Clinton were really pretty good friends and have an awful lot to, you know, in common with each other and with Donald Trump, frankly. You know, they're all like peas in a pod.
Well, Trump always used to schmooze with the Clintons. It makes you wonder sort of how much of this enmity is real and how much is staged.
And there's kind of a point to that to some extent. But it wasn't until the Tea Party people, and I mean the real idiots, came to town, you know, with the chawing tobacco and the corn cob in their back pocket and the wheat sheaf behind the ear. Until they came, there weren't any climate denialists. Now there were climate folks, and they were on the payroll. I mean, none of them believed any of it, but you know, for $30,000 a month, you know, which buys a really nice house and puts money away for the kids and pays for the car. Especially when you've done some jail time on you, you're gonna the 30,000. Take a look about this. Am I gonna represent the coal industry? Am I gonna come out and tell their story? You know, I went to law school anyway, so I've been representing rapists and killers already, which is pretty much like the coal industry as it is. It's kind of exactly who they are. But 30 grand a month when it's you personally. You were making $6,000 a month. You were living in a one-bedroom rented apartment. You now have 6,000 square feet in Alexandria. You have a three-car garage. You have two E-Series Mercedes. I mean, this is the first I'm talking about. This is his life. And he began, I worked with him on his investment portfolio because we looked at his children and his grandchildren, how many years. And I said, how long can you stomach these people? I did 2 years in federal prison, and I'm not going to describe what happened to me there. But, compared to being I can't say the word, I'm on radio right now, but if you, having that happen to you in federal prison, working for the coal industry is not that much different, and I'm getting paid for it this time. I want to stop talking to one of my friends because he's taking the money because he needed it because he couldn't get a job so his kids, you know, could go to college so they could do well. You know, and this is what it is in Washington, all of this. It's like you, for many of you out there, all of you during your last divorce, all of you, and you know I'm talking to out there.
probably a few listeners in that category, I would imagine.
Yeah, including me, you know. And you go to court and your lawyer's yelling at the other lawyer and the judge is yelling at them. And then they break and the lawyers both go up to the judge and then they leave together with their arms around each other going to lunch. And then they come back and start yelling at each other. It's like one of those Roadrunner and Sheepdog or Coyote and Sheepdog cartoons. And there's you and the wife or the husband or whatever staring at each other and you paid these guys $10,000, $12,000, $15,000, $18,000, $20,000, and you realize it's cheap theater, and you've paid for a ticket that maybe had been better off if you just decided to divvy it up, because they're going to leave with your money, you're not going to leave with your money. Well, it's pretty much the Washington two-step.
Yeah, that's kind of how it works in Washington.
Yeah, let me explain to you how the Russian thing went. Trump and the Russians.
So what is that about? Because we heard, even in the mainstream media and the debates, we heard Hillary Clinton talking about how the Russians were, you know, possibly going to mess with the election and try to hand it to Trump. And we're saying this wasn't complete hot air.
No, they messed with the election and handed the, yeah, they did this. They hacked the election and they didn't have a lot of choice. I tell you how this started. Kevin and I, a couple of years ago, and let me chastise some. There are internet people. I won't even say, you know, just even my friend Jeff Rentz is an internet guy. All of the podcasters are internet people. I beat Kevin over the head sometime because I work in security. My clients are governments. I simply, when I know everybody in Syria, Iraq, Iran. I know in Russia, I know them personally. I go to Italy, I meet with the government. You know, I discuss security, carbon area. I meet with them. I was with them a couple of weeks ago. I just left West Africa, where I addressed the Joint Chiefs of Staff of two African militaries. You know, we work on development stuff. We work on defense stuff. I help them set up intelligence schools, surveillance programs, counterterrorism training. All of this stuff. I've got a contract. I represent the government of Nigeria, of Kenya, several others. And this is what we do.
And so you're saying you're one of them, they're pointy-headed elitists that goes to Davos, Switzerland, and hangs out with the rich folk?
No, I'm one of those guys that runs around the car in Ghana. You go on my Facebook, and you'll see me visiting the grave of Kwame Nkrumah there.
So what do you think of Nkrumah, by the way? Because I understand you may have done some work involving that era.
Yeah. Well, I used to work with a government agency, and West Africa was one of my areas. And let's
tell the listeners, Nkrumah was a very, very famous sort of independence-era African leader who was, you know, he was a little bit on the same page, supposedly, as Lumumba that, you know, the CIA killed over in Congo. So anyway, Nkrumah was a big hero.
There's a little museum out, you know, his grave is in front, and then the museum they wouldn't let me film in. And there were the photos of him, the original photos with Lumumba, one with John Kennedy, by the way. With
Kennedy was a fan of those guys.
Yeah.
Funny how all the good guys get whacked, isn't it?
This is a guy that was overthrown in 1966 while he was in North Vietnam meeting with Ho Chi Minh about setting up a peace conference to end the Vietnam War. And the U.S. came in and overthrew. And then, of course, for the next 12 years, we overthrew seven other governments in Ghana. And the purpose primarily, this had the world's largest supply of bauxite, alumina. And they were. This is a country that also has the one of the largest world potentials for hydroelectric power. So rather than having them develop a hydroelectric power, which would have allowed them to produce, industrialize and produce aluminum, we stole their bauxite for nothing, kept them enslaved, with one military dictatorship after another. And when I could explain to people my own position in that, how I'd worked for agencies involved in doing that, and the mechanisms for it, and my own feelings about that, and I have a long history of taking the right side on those things. It's, you know, it's how I was raised.
You and John Perkins, you know, in some way.
I was raised in a communist family, you know. And, I'm the grandson of a coal miner. My mother grew up in a, for any of you out here, think you're old time coal miners or whatever. My mother grew up in a mining camp outside of Hazard, Kentucky called Glomar, G-L-O-M-A-R. And I come from one of those families where people didn't have shoes. You know, this is that, it's that side of the world. And when my father was orphaned in 1910, that's when his father died. You know, so, you know, I'm dealing with people who knew poverty. You know, I come out of that crap. But,
So it's possible to work for these agencies that are basically raping the world, like John Perkins did, and apparently like you have, and still sort of try to advocate for the victims.
Oh yeah, if you don't take a seat at the table, what are you going to do? Become an internet freak? You know, let me just grind a little on here. We have all these people who used to sort of did. Where I used to work for 30 years ago, I worked for the Treasury Department as a deputy assistant undersecretary of some kind of crap, you know. And now I know everything because 35 years ago I was a deputy assistant undersecretary of whatever the hell it was. Well, 2 weeks ago I was making a presentation on Boko Haram sitting in Nigeria, you know, with the heads of their military. You know, and riding around the back of a cart, and of course, bidding, and you know, meeting people and hanging out.
So did you tell them that Boko Haram is part of this massive false flag scam?
When you spend 4 days with people and they're there doing this, they're enormously aware that it's part
of it. You don't have to tell them.
You don't have to tell them. They're there. They, all the stuff you talk about, real people already know it. The point being here is that. And even Sobrowski, who I love like a stepchild, by the way, an evil stepchild, but it is.
Yeah, Alan Sobrowski, the face of Israel did 9/11, along with
and we're on the page in so much stuff, and he's a fun guy, but Sobrowski has just been out of it for too many years. And hey, you know, we're both Vietnam vets, we're both combat vets. Alan stays pretty close to home. He doesn't take a lot of stress. Not many people do. And frankly, you know, I don't enjoy airport after airport, 20-some hours on planes, the crap. And I like the people I work with. And I like working in West Africa. I'm very much at home there. It is a great feeling of community for those of us who really work around black people in the real world and who work around those Arabs that were supposed to be chasing out, and I find them delightful people to work with, friendly and trustworthy. Of course, I like working with Jews too.
Well, you're definitely on the wrong side of the new Trumpy America if he takes after the Saud family and decides to name the country after himself, which will probably happen after they blow up the tower, the Trump Tower. Did you hear that the FAA has now declared controlled airspace around Trump Tower?
Yeah. This is what an absolute joke. Well, let's explain the Russia thing here. And probably finishing the idea. We were talking earlier about Pat Buchanan, and that's a used to sort of was Nixon's speechwriter. Not an active operational person, not a policymaker, not active in any kind of security organization, which by active I mean where you occasionally have to beat someone to death with a tire iron in a dark alley in a country you've never been in before. That's what an operational person does. And
I would apply for that job personally.
Yeah, when you get back to a little hotel room and you put duct tape on the areas that you can't get stitched up till you get home, and you're flying home, hoping you don't bleed through your shoes while you're sitting in the, you know, sitting back in business class, usually, by the way, when you're doing that kind of prep. And
so you never want to forget your duct tape.
And you don't You don't feel very well, by the way. It's slightly upsetting doing this stuff. Well, and you've got other people who, you know, God only knows it's 1969 and I'm, you know, walking rice paddies with an M16 rifle and some of my friends in South Vietnam, you know, and we get shot at and periodically people get hit with things and whatever, and I could whine about that my whole life, and so many people do, and God help me, it doesn't mean a damn thing. Get over it. It was 50 years ago. Get over it. Move on. Get rid of the little hat. Move on. It's time to move on. But people will have a job 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago, Pat Buchanan, and the rest of their lives they spend trying to pretend that what they did 40 years ago had, where people took them to lunch, their entire lives then involved going to an office, kissing somebody's ass like Richard Nixon, then that had to be pretty unpleasant. And then lying to people, and then the only information you got is what people decided they would tell you, and it was your job to take one set of lies and stew them into another. You've never seen the truth at all. You have no background in anything, and you're here as a pundit explaining the world that you've never lived in to other people who are frankly about to have the other shoe drop here in this country. And I can't do anything about it. And I...
Well, let's talk about that. Of course, you're talking about how people like Alan Zabrowski, Pat Buchanan, and a lot of other people who probably should know better have been drinking the Trump Kool-Aid. And, you know, I've been sort of tasting it to see what it, you know, tastes like.
Why listen to, you know, any of them? Let's we're having this talk about the coal lobby a minute ago. Let me finish this idea. And if you're in Wyoming and you're mining coal, okay, and somebody tells you that they're going to deregulate coal, cut environmental regulations on power plants, and it's going to use a whole lot more coal. Well, you never went to business school. You're a coal miner. And whether you're bright, you may be a bright coal miner. God only knows. You know, they're out there. You know, you can find somebody in a coal mine, they're going to be brilliant. You know, I've had it happen to me. You know, you look at somebody, you assume who they're, well, that guy's black. He's got to be an idiot. Oh, yeah, don't sit across a chessboard from him. You'll be sorry. You'll learn who has the gray matter and who doesn't. It doesn't work the way you think it does. But you're the coal guy, and you voted to get your job. Well, you know what? There's kind of an interesting point. Let's talk about power plants a little bit. Power plants used to all run on coal. Some of them ran on nuclear. And we're a little hesitant about doing nuclear power plants. I'm sitting between the Enrico Fermi and the Davis-Besse power plant right now. One's 30 miles away, one's 20 miles away. Chances of me living to a ripe old age of 90-something without glowing in the dark isn't, because they're both leaking all the time.
Really? You know, can you pull out a Geiger counter and prove that?
It's in the paper. We just had a leak, but it wasn't too bad. But don't go near Lake Erie. You know, because, and the fish are doing...
Fish are mutating.
Well, no, you can actually, you know, on the surface, they actually produce a glow, like in the Batman fluid stuff.
But
talking about power plants, well, you know why we're not using so much coal and we're down 20%? Is because natural gas is cheaper and more efficient to deliver. So the plants converted to natural gas. Well, if we ease regulations on power plants, the problem is the only way we're going to get more coal miners' jobs is by selling more coal. And in order to sell more coal, we'll have to raise the price of natural gas, except Trump is deregulating the natural gas too, so its price is going to go down even more, meaning we're down 20% in 12 months in coal. And I'll tell you, the next year it's going to go down 5 more percent. It doesn't matter the deregulation. All that's going to do is produce more profit and more dirt and more disease. But it's not going to produce more coal, make 1 more cent a wage, not at all, because the free market is what runs the energy business, and people are going to buy natural gas because they don't have to haul it around in trains. It goes through 12-inch pipelines because it's produced by fracking, and we have so much natural gas, we're never, ever going to run out of it. We find natural gas. You can't stick a finger in the ground without natural gas coming out, and it's everywhere. and coal comes out of those trains, have to whack across the country, and we have to handle it. And even if there were no regulations, and deregulating isn't going to take the cost of producing energy down. The only thing that's going to make coal more attractive is by seriously lowering the cost of coal. And the only way that can be done would be by halving the wages of the people who are mining the coal. There is no more economy there. You can't take the transportation cost out. You can't take the cost of mining coal. The only thing we can do is cut the wages or get rid of a lot of the people, maybe. You know, but no, you know, we had the coal people had to all go out. Now, all the coal people, and they were doing what they thought was right, except they didn't know any better. The problem is that no one told them any better. Why they weren't told any better, why they weren't told the truth, because they don't have a union. Now, the union, it may not have been the right, but telling people the truth, somebody should have told them the truth. Somebody. But nobody did. And it's their lives. These are families. They've got homes. They send people to school. I don't mean them ill. You know, people cut down trees. I'd rather they didn't clear cut trees or whatever, but my God, what are they going to all do? Work at Walmart for $8.10 an hour? You know, if you can make $21 an hour, $18 an hour doing something, and your kids have the things they need, and you can maybe take a 2-week vacation. I don't want people to go without. But
is this kind of the backdrop? As I look at this kind of in the long term, this series of, you know, election shenanigans, you know, 9/11 and this latest 11/9, and all of this seems to be based on this slowdown or stagnation of what we always used to take for granted, which was constant, serious, fast economic growth, offering each of us opportunity for a better life in our lifetimes and an even better life for our kids. And that has been pretty much dead in the water for a generation now. And I think that explains a whole lot of the shenanigans in the political realm, because, you know, how are you going to govern people and control people in that situation when the only thing that's held us together is this sort of joint dream, the American dream of ever-increasing prosperity, and that's gone now. And so, you know, this Trump phenomenon seems to me to be emerging out of that, and somebody played played us beautifully with this backlash against...
I'm in Lansing today. I was at Horrocks in Lansing buying vegetables, and mostly I bought several cases of wine, too. They've really got a nice wine shop there. But... I'm coming home here listening to National Public Radio and the local station, and they're doing the news, and four of the local schools, and including Okemos. I was a student teacher at Okemos back in the 1970s, and it's a pretty upscale area. And numerous assaults of minority students, and, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, if you're a minority living in Okemos, you know, you're not a poor minority. It's one of those towns of great big houses, college professors, medical people, stuff like that. You know, you don't live there for under $400,000 anyway. A house, minimal, and way above that in a lot of cases. And
so the upper middle class white kids are assaulting the upper middle class minority kids?
Pretty much, yeah. You know, and now in DeWitt, you know, you go both ways. That's north of town. Still some farming people there. I've got an old girlfriend that lives up there, Kathy. Hi, Kathy, if you're listening. And she owns a plant business on Turner Street in Lansing, if anyone cares to go there. Nice person.
And if you say that Truth Jihad Radio sent you, she'll probably throw in an extra flower with your purchase.
She would. She has a flower business. And, it's hard to stay on terms with an old girlfriend for 45 years. Yeah, you know, not allow that. But she likes my wife better than she likes me anyway. Which is too often the case.
We don't want to get into too many details here, Gordon.
Your personal life. Nobody really, you know, getting into the... So much insane has happened. And we're going to jump around a little bit because there's a reason for this. If I lay this out as I know it to be and, you know, call it disclosure... Remember, I'm a guy that believes in UFOs. I am a guy, but
You're all out for UFO disclosure, for Tesla free energy disclosure, all that stuff.
But I do not harp about these things because I will only, when I believe I have information that people deserve to have because it affects their lives. Otherwise, if you keep pouring this stuff out on people, you know, create awareness of hopelessness, you know, it isn't doing anybody a favor.
Right.
Plus, a lot of the stuff, you know, unless you see something yourself, you're getting it from a briefing. If you're getting it from a briefing, 40% of what you're hearing in every briefing is a lie. It's always the case. Sometimes it's 80%. And, you know, that's what did Winston Churchill say about that the truth is so important that it has to be guarded by, it has to have a bodyguard.
Bodyguard of lies. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's very much the case. So there is no free lunch in briefing stuff. And I am not always qualified to ascertain what's real and what's not.
There's no easy, sure solution to this problem of sifting through information and figuring out what's really going on.
And the effort to learn the difference requires a focus and access no one will pay to have, because in order to get information, you have to have value yourself. In order to be of value, you have to live a life that those people who 35 or 40 years ago wrote something for a president or worked on a policy paper or taught somewhere at a military school or whatever, and for the decade after decade after decade after that, sat at Denny's and would yell across there to the waitress, you know, I used to teach at the War College, you know, that kind of stuff. it just doesn't work. Now, if you want to actually go places and do stuff, you know,
the reality-based community.
You have to talk. If you think you can live and do things in this world and not talk to the Jews, if you think that Iran is a wonderful country and they wouldn't sell us down the river as people to slaughter if they had to save themselves, Russians the same, Vladimir Putin the same, if you think we have any real friends, if you think anybody cares what happens to you, you're absolutely nuts. This is a dog-eat-dog world, and there are very few people in this world, fewer every day, that, you know, value, as Hanke calls it, truth and beauty, the idea of honor and loyalty. It is an antiquated thing in today's world. But
It's going out of style. Well, you know, getting back to this election thing, because you really have made yourself the point man, I think, for the people ahead of the curve on Trump, you know, figuring out where he's really coming from, this particular mob background he has, who's using him now, for what purposes. And you were telling me earlier today that you're taking a pretty pessimistic line on what's coming down the pipe.
I'm just saying here that, I could do this. Why I mentioned the folks, the coal miner folks, because they thought they were doing what was right for their families. They didn't. Because of ignorance, and ignorance is not excusable, because an entire community failed to find any source. It's funny, when you don't gather together, when you don't channel your intelligence, when you don't seek expertise, it's when you don't have a trade union, you're not going to have people who understand market trends and will explain to you what it is you really want. How do you maintain your jobs? And then, of course, you know, the kind of deals that needed to be cut is your enemy in the coal business is natural gas. And what your negotiation here is, if you're dealing with the power companies and you're working with your employer, the coal producer, both of you share a common enemy, and that's cheap natural gas is your enemy. And the leverage you use, you try to gain leverage over the power companies. That's, and it has nothing to do with Washington and regulation. Nothing at all.
How do you gain leverage over power companies in those terms?
You know, and that's why you hire somebody like me to figure out a way to do it. That's what a picture does. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then you can always...
Wait, you go out to dinner with the executives and bribe them, or what?
If you have to, yes, you do.
Yeah, I kind of guessed that. Well, okay, so how does this relate to the your dim view of the future of America under a Trump regime?
Well, it's... if any of us are lying to, you know, I don't need to get into this. I don't need to, you know, we've got people running around beating up minorities in schools that are kids, and I've got people who think they're doing well now because they've got their guy. Even in any of those that can read and write, anybody that tell me about the awakening of Tony Hall. I think that's the explanation. But Tony was a Trump boy, wasn't he?
He was starting to lean that way. I mean, Tony, like me, has been observing this whole process with kind of a jaundiced and appalled eye. But at some point along the line, he's starting to take bigger and bigger swigs of that Trump Kool-Aid. And then this past week, this election happened, and quickly thereafter, he's, he sees your work and he's going, is that just Gordon or is Gordon onto something? And, I sent him a couple of other pieces on Trump's mob background, which we have been talking about before, and it's starting to sink in with him. And then he sees your election piece on the missing 10, 15 plus million votes. And then Mark Crispin Miller validates it for him. Mark Crispin Miller being kind of the very orthodox, careful, fully employed NYU professor and expert on vote fraud.
We did our homework on this, and the damn thing is that everybody knows this. There has been not only a press shutdown. I just tell you right now that Obama. Let's go back to 1992. And I was working in 1992. In 1990, I helped manage the campaign, the Michigan gubernatorial campaign for John Engler. And Engler was campaign manager later for George Herbert Walker Bush. But, Engler and I were, I can't say real close friends, but I'd go to Lansing. I lived in Grand Rapids. I'd go to Lansing, East Grand Rapids. You got to differentiate there because it's ritzier. I'd go to Lansing and sit in the office with the governor, feet up on the table, and we'd drink scotch and hang out. And there were always picketers or rioters or whatever, because he wasn't the most light guy in the world. And I used to walk him over to the Capitol from his office building there. In Lansing at the corner of Michigan and Capitol Avenue. And we walk over together and usually have one or two state police guards behind us. And this screw around. But I worked as an election strategist, and I was also the periodic sit-in date at state dinners for Michigan's extremely aged, but female, Lieutenant Governor, when her husband wasn't around. I was the fourth at dinner in those times. And then one of the heads of the Republican Party, Saul Anousis, this longtime friend. Then Guy Gordon was the fixer, and a very close friend was the fixer for the Republican Party at the time. And he showed up mysteriously suicided sometime later. But quite a person. But I used to hang out with these guys, and I did some of the policy work on tax reform, welfare reform, communications, telecommunications reform. Bruce Yule and I wrote that bill. But I come out of that work, and I'm an RNC member since 1986. So I've and I have some. Some status in Republican National Committee. And frankly, working with Republicans is way easier for me than working with Democrats. They are a pain in the ass to deal with. I follow their domestic programs because Republicans, there's nothing conservative about Republicans anymore. When we did Michigan in 1990, when we did welfare reform, it was an effective program and changed a lot of things. We, did a lot of education reform, and we went after the teachers union. And God only knows I'm a, you know, I'm a union guy, but when we had a teacher convicted of rape and we couldn't even have him transferred from his school, that was an indication we had an out of control union. So I mean, right.
Republicans used to actually be associated with these kinds of sensible reforms. Tommy Thompson here in Wisconsin was one of these kind of relatively sensible Republicans. Very, very different from what we've got now with Scott Walker.
Yeah, this is it. It was a very different thing, at the time. And I was as involved as I could be. But also, the kind of things we would do is they would have me write a bill up, a regulatory bill, and then they would take it to the lobbyist and say, if you don't give me $50,000, we're going to support this regulatory bill and it's going to screw you. And then they come back and, I've worked on this thing for real, And, well, Gordon, you got us the $50,000 we needed to win that the Senate campaign, Oh, yeah. Or on the other hand, the bill I wrote would have cut telecommunications costs and would have brought in new industry or kept industry from leaving the state because it would have made the business environment in Michigan better. God help us, should we do that?
When I ran for Congress in 2008, one of my top issues was a law that would call any campaign contribution of $200 and over to an office holder a presumed bribe, in the same way that, a certain amount of drugs is presumed sales. And so that would basically outlaw any such contributions because they are bribes, right? I mean, why do we allow this?
You can't have lunch with somebody in Washington for that kind of money.
Exactly. So that's a good way to get money out of politics by enforcing the anti-bribery laws.
$50,000 to have lunch with the committee chair.
Right, right. And this, of course, is the kind of thing that makes people tear their hair out and vote for Trump. This level of endemic corruption.
Let me explain Russia's position and why Russia took us out. And I apologize to the foreign ministry today personally, literally. I was on the phone there because since we do have editors with the Russian foreign ministry, I apologize to them for naming them because I like them, But they, I'm just saying, we didn't have it coming, and no matter how bad a condition you're in, but here's how it started. We started back.
And we have less than 10 minutes, so we're going to have to.
37 minutes ago, we began talking about Vicki Nuland and why Victoria Nuland, the wife of the Kagan brothers, that's one of my inside jokes, by the way, from the Institute of the Study of War, classic neocons, and neocons who initially came out against Trump so that the Kool-Aid drinkers would say, well, the neocons really aren't for Trump, not realizing that Giuliani and Bolton are the real neocons of all time. And they were backing Trump from day number one. You stupid idiots. Oh, my God, what a pack of fools. But that's fine. I'm going to do all right. I'm going to be doing fine. I'll rake in money. They're going to, because I treat them like crap. And they respect that. And they're going to want to hear from me. They're going to all opposition research. They want to know what I have on them. They'll want to, because I have what they need, and they don't need anything from you because they already got your vote. And for those of you who weren't out on the streets, they have your silence and acquiescence to a coup against the United States. They have yours. They don't have mine. I still have value. You have none.
Well, Gordon, how do we get the people out there in the streets to hold up signs saying stolen election?
It's not my job. I wrote the article. You guys can deal with it. I laid out the facts. That's it. I'm not going to preach. I'm going to go watch television, open a bottle of Riesling, and get some pretzels. But explain Russia. So Ms. Kagan Nuland decides to work with Polish neo Nazis, whatever, tons of CIA money, drug money, and secretly, backed by the neocons and the Israelis, secretly, it was the Israelis. The Israelis moved against Ukraine. It was them. By not all Israelis, not evil Jews. Extremist Israelis tied, specific extremist Likudist Israelis tied to international organized crime.
Bibi's gang.
Bibi's gang. Not the people of Israel. This gang of people. Here was the game. Once they took Ukraine, which includes Crimea and Odessa, Russia is cut off from the Black Sea militarily. Russia, talk about red lines, Russia cannot have that. Russia was forced. This was done. Ukraine was taken for one reason, to force Russia to take Crimea. Almost immediately thereafter, the blame went out for what the neocons did and the Likudists did. George Soros did it! George Soros, because George Soros is a Jew! George Soros is a neocon! No, George Soros is a Democrat. George Soros is the guy right now, if he's the guy they're asking for money to go to the Electoral College and fight Trump's taking over, based on the information we have now. Soros is the only hope this country has. But no, I read on the internet that he's a neocon and a Jew and that he's overthrowing all these countries. Oh, sure he is.
Well, I wouldn't defend everything Soros does, Gordon, by any means. His activities in Malaysia, I would actually side with Mahathir Mohamad on that one. But I agree with you that just because Soros is giving somebody money doesn't mean that those people are necessarily doing bad work. He is an idealist as well as a slimeball and a financier.
If this were 2003, we had two people in this country, and Kevin will have a third, but two people that stood up to George W. Bush. One of them bought full-page ads in the New York Times saying that there was no reason to invade Iraq, that the whole thing was fabricated. That guy was George Soros.
And Jimmy Walter was buying full-page ads in the New York Times and the Washington Post saying 9/11 was an inside job, and then he was chased out of the country.
Yeah. Well, George Soros didn't get chased out of the country, but George Soros stood up against the war. He stood up against the Patriot Act. He stood up against the only one to do that. And then the only one that stood against the neocons and who has continually stood against Israel. My God, if you go into the Israeli papers, to them, George Soros is Satan. He's a monster. To the people that we know are the monsters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have 2 minutes to wrap this one up.
And it only takes 2 minutes. So the Russians were forced to go into Crimea, and that forced, absolutely forced, against his will, Barack Obama, to put sanctions on Russia. And that created leverage. And that leverage was used by the same Israelis who set Russia up and set up taking the Ukraine. Not George Soros, the Israelis set it up with their little people, their people all over Europe. And led by their neocons, and done right in the middle of the Obama administration, they had that kind of power. And the Russians found themselves against the wall with sanctions destroying them economically. And then they are promised, mind you, they are promised that Trump is going to recognize Crimea, and it's going to end the sanctions, and all they have to do is get rid of Hillary Clinton. Everything they need to survive. And then they have to please Israel, and all they have to do is to let somebody shoot Assad.
And so what's your source on that one?
I don't have a source on that one. That one's just me.
Okay.
Yeah. That one's just me. The other stuff. So
with the hack that threw the election, the hack that threw the election came out of Macedonia. It's done by Bibi's gang, and the Russians are sort of fronting for it.
What I told the Russians today is until they're a couple of things have, very quickly.
This is about 10 seconds.
Yeah, when Trump announced that he was going to maybe not step down if he lost the election, he already knew he had the election rigged, and he was making it impossible for Hillary or Obama to do something.
Exactly, because they condemned. They said, if you say things like that, you're an evil conspiracy theorist. So they can't say things like that, even if they're true. Well, thank you, Gordon Duff. I appreciate your uncommon insights. always ahead of the curve. Keep up the great work, and let's hope some of those people out this week.
Kevin, it just doesn't matter. It's too late.
It's too late. No, it's too late. On the radio link to find links to all of my shows, or you could even subscribe for $3.95 a month and get early access plus free downloads. Once again, the place to do that is truthjihad.com. Okay, let's move on to our second hour. That first hour is kind of a doozy. People who haven't been following these stories may be scratching their heads. We're going to put up links at the radio blog site for this particular show, and you can read the stuff yourself and see what you think. But unfortunately, it does look to me like Gordon Duff may very well be right about this, about who Trump really is, where he really comes from. This was a big false flag operation, that 11/9 will go down in history as another 9/11, if not worse. Yeah, I wish it weren't that way. I wish Trump were everything his Kool-Aid, supporters think he is, imagine he is, dream he is, but my analysis is that just ain't happening, folks, I'm sorry to say. All right, well, let's try and bring up Nick Bam, author of Malvern. This is a 9/11 truth novel, which I have added to my extensive collection of 9/11 truth novels, and this is a very, very readable one. I probably, got through this in fewer sittings than just about any. It's very readable. And it's an interesting scenario. Maybe we'll learn a little more about what inspired it from the man himself. Welcome, Nick Bam. How are you doing, Nick?
Good evening, Kevin. Good to be with you.
Yeah, all right. Well, I enjoyed your novel. I read it pretty much straight through. It's an epistolary novel, which is an antiquated form, a novel in the form of letters. And nobody writes letters anymore. They write emails. And so it's a novel in the form of emails.
Exactly. And I'm glad you wrote it straight through. It's very funny. When I spoke to a few people early on, I asked them if they would. One more indulgence, I said, can you just allow yourself 90 minutes or 2 hours to read it straight through? And everybody said, fine, except for one person. And she said, why? And nobody asked me why before. And I thought about it for a minute. And that actually is the first time it occurred to me that the book didn't have any chapters.
Right. It's just a bunch of emails. For me, reading this book was actually almost easier than going through my inbox, and probably more entertaining.
That's right. I edited them all for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So, the Great American 9/11 Truth Novel. What a concept. Everybody wants to write one. And, there's a whole collection of them, and they sit right here on my shelf. And, there's the good, the bad, the ugly, the quasi-bestseller from Steve Alton, who writes bestsellers about dinosaur monsters chasing people through the streets and stuff. His 9/11 book is not the best, I have to admit. There are some pretty good ones out there. And Thomas Pynchon has this book, Bleeding Edge, which is, a darn good novel with a really interesting 9/11 truth component in it. And the Wall Street Journal trashed it because it was a 9/11 truther novel by our greatest writer, Thomas Pynchon, all this crap. But anyway, it's a very noble thing to try to, to put out a 9/11 truth novel and do it well. And this is a really interesting scenario you've got in this novel that seems to intersect with some actuality. The main character here, Rob, is the manager of a kind of a public access TV station in Woodstock, New York. And this got my bells ringing, saying, wait a minute. This scenario is a little bit like what happened when Loose Change guys managed to get their film shown. I thought it was on public access in Woodstock, New York, and then Fox News saw it and picked it up and broadcast it, and suddenly Loose Change was the internet sensation, and it went up to over millions of views, maybe 100 million views. I don't know what it was, but it became a massive sensation, and theoretically it could have changed the world, and we could have busted these 9/11 perps, but we didn't. And so your novel presents a situation a little bit like that. Is this what you were thinking about when you wrote it?
It's funny because I remember Loose Change was one of the first ones, and that was playing on a loop outside, inside a Saugerties, New York bookstore window. Saugerties is about 10 miles over from Woodstock, and in fact was the town where I was on the cable access television committee. But as the character Rob says in the book, I mean, one of the jokes of the book is that Rob is probably the bottom rung on the American economic ladder. He's the program director for a cable access television station, but it being in Woodstock, New York makes all the difference. And as he says to his boss, we have the name recognition of Gandhi.
Yeah, that's cultural capital.
Yeah, and because of that, he gets to promote his ideas. But I was not aware that Loose Change had its premiere in that area. No,
well, I'll have to go back and confirm that. But I think it did have its premiere in upstate New York on a cable access channel, and then Fox News brought those guys on, and that's what launched it. And I don't know if it was Woodstock, New York. Maybe I'm, confusing your novel with reality, but
right.
You should look into that and see, because I think it might have been.
I thought Loose Change was very good.
Oh, I did too. I thought it was brilliant. I mean, and, interestingly, I thought that it didn't really get better as they put out these new versions that were more supposedly fact-checked and so on.
Right.
I thought the first couple of ones were the best.
Do you remember by any chance, this was going back, but there was a French guy who put out a book. I mean, I think it was in maybe 2 months of 9/11.
Yeah, that was Thierry Masson. I know him. Right. He's a great guy. Yeah, his book, which was called L'effroyable imposture, which would be the hideous fraud. It was translated into English as, what was it, 9/11, the big lie. And anyway, that came out right away after 9/11, and it set publishing records in France. No book in French publishing history has ever sold out of the box the way that book did. And it created a huge firestorm and then huge pushback. And basically, he got run out of the country, and he's been living in Syria ever since.
That hasn't happened to me yet, but I can only hope.
Yeah. Well, if you'd managed to set publishing records here with your book, you probably would get run out of the country. That's how it works. The more successful you are, the worse they treat you.
Well, exactly. And I've got to say, I mean, just to bring it back to this book for just a second, I go back to Jonathan Livingston Seagull, if you remember that book.
Dates
me too. But the thing is that every once in a while, there is a book that just for whatever reason catches the fancy. And while I was writing this book, and as you said about the email, the epistle, and all that stuff, I just thought, this really does have a chance to be one of those types of books that people just, I was waiting for the same reaction, I guess, the guys who did Loose Change were waiting for.
Well, when you put out a book and you wait for that reaction, usually you're going to wait a long time because, there's the book market, as I've learned, as I just put out my false flag trilogy about the latest big false flag attacks, it's pretty saturated. It's not that easy to sell books for a living. Take it from me.
I know that. Now, do you have a publisher, though?
Well, I've had both self-published books and I've had publishers, and I've actually had much better luck with the self-published books. I've made a lot more money, a vastly lot more money, which isn't saying that much, but it's
right.
More than nothing on my self-published books than on the published ones. So go figure.
Congratulations.
Well, yeah, such as it is. I mean, basically, my first book was Dr. Weird's Weird Tours, A Guide to Mysterious San Francisco, written under the pen name of Dr. Eldritch Weird, with an E on the end of weird. And that book takes you to all of the locations where, crazy stuff happened in San Francisco, historic locations where Charles Manson lived and where Allen Ginsberg took peyote and saw the vision of Moloch in the financial district and all this kind
good
of
idea.
Stuff. Grateful Dead House. And yeah, it's actually a darn good book, I have to admit. And it set the pattern for these weird tour guides that have followed. There's a book called Weird Wisconsin. It's a copycat. There are dozens and dozens of these copycats. And my book was the original weird tour guide. And it did really well. I sold 2 huge print runs right out of the box in the first year. And then I stupidly turned it over to a publisher, Last Gasp of San Francisco, and that was the last gasp for the book. Basically, haven't heard a peep from them since. They won't return my phone calls. The book was up to selling for several $100 a copy for a while on Amazon, and now it's way back down. And you kind of have to wonder what the publisher may be doing with those photographic prints. I'm not accusing them of anything, but hey, guys over at Last Gasp, Ron Turner, head of Last Gasp, please call me back next time I call you, or I'm going to have to keep talking about you on the radio.
I don't think he's listening.
Nah, probably not. So anyway, your book, you got a seagull on the cover. You're hoping it'll follow Jonathan Livingston's,
No, that was actually, that's funny because Malvern is plays a very big part in the story. In fact, that's one of the keys, when he's telling, Chaz back in Malvern, the school where he went to many years earlier, he says about his nights with his girlfriend. He says, Chaz, I can hardly believe I'm telling you this, yet I lived it and didn't think a thing. And the reason for the name Malvern is because that's what he's trying to create. The first time, Malvern just happened to him. And when he says to his friend Andy, Andy, what he plans to do, and Andy says, you make it seem so easy, and he replies, it is easy. We'll look back and it'll look impossible, and we'll have forgotten how easy it was. What he's trying to do is recreate exactly what happened at Malvern, just a time where you were just doing these wonderful things. They're just coming naturally. And Malvern is in the hills, the famous Malvern Hills, which is actually also famous for its water. It was a spa at the turn of the century, the previous century. In fact, Darwin took his daughter there to treat her, but she died. So that was, I was actually drawing the Malvern Hills with a few sketches. And then on that one, as I saw, it also resembled a bird taking off. I thought that worked well with both the hills being at school and flight. So that's the one I kept.
I see. So essentially that just kind of kicking back and doing it, the main character, Rob, is kind of, he's middle-aged by now. And he's kind of, you know, he's not at the top rung of the career ladder running this public access station in Woodstock, New York.
Right.
And so his kind of flashing back to his youth at Malvern, where, you know, just you dream it and it happens kind of thing, becomes what helps him break 9/11 truth out.
Right. Exactly. He's trying to recreate it. There's one thing, but there's a line there when Chaz is saying to him, we remember when you had to go across to the other side of the field and we turned to look at you walking down the length of the field and we saw that everybody else on the sidelines turned to watch you walk too. You know, and that's what's happening 30 years later. He says to Chaz, you know, that was a different world. Well, it's a world he misses. In fact, I will say this. If I entitled the book anything other than Malvern, it really wouldn't have been as good a book, because titling it Malvern, the book is all cracks. The whole email format, the reader is required to fill in so many of the blanks. And all those cracks are, in effect, filled in by calling it Malvern, because that's what the book is about. That one time, there's a reference to, he says to his sister, one of the last emails, about how Finian's Rainbow has always been his favorite musical. In fact, that is a real email in exchange I did have with my sister, and she was in Finian's Rainbow. For the book's sake, it probably would have been better had I used Brigadoon, for those of you who know your 50s musicals, because Brigadoon was more of this magical place in the hills. But that's what Malvern was really to Rob, this magical place in the hills that he is trying to recreate. And the only instance I can think of where a title has lent so much to something where it's really not the point of the story is the great film Chinatown. There are a couple of references to Chinatown, but it's not
about... It's Chinatown, Jake.
Exactly. It's not about Chinatown, and it is about Chinatown. And Malvern operates in the same way with this book.
Yeah. Well, of course, in Chinatown, the point is that basically after this investigator played by, was it Jack Nicholson?
Right.
Yeah, he's kind of stuck his nose in places where it doesn't belong. He's discovered this insane level of corruption in high places. And somehow I kind of suspect that that's a pretty accurate reflection of how it really works. In this case, it was about how the rich folks rigged up the water supply for Los Angeles. Anyway, he gets his nose broken, sticking it in the wrong places. And, you know, these detectives, they all know that Chinatown is corrupt, right? Of course, it's Chinatown. Well, it turns out the whole place, the whole country is Chinatown. And if you're rich enough, you can get away with absolutely anything, murder and worse.
Right. Well, I actually never took that to mean the whole country, but you're absolutely right. That could be a kind of an interpretation.
Well, you call it the country, the state, the city, yeah. L.A., of course. That's what this was about, is how L.A. Yeah. is this completely, as Faulkner said, it's the plastic asshole of the universe. And it's only there because they stole the water. And how did they steal the water? Well, these insanely corrupt folks that Jack Nicholson runs into are the ones that did it, and they're living very, very high on the hog, and they're untouchable, and they continue to commit the most horrendous crimes, and nobody can go there because it's proverbially corrupt. If Chinatown, the actual Chinatown in L.A. or San Francisco or New York or wherever, is proverbially corrupt, a kind of a self-contained unit that you're never going to break into. You're never going to deal with the gangs that run this place. Well, Los Angeles is like that too, as a city. And you get right down to it, the world is like that too.
Yeah, and then there's a great story out there. You probably know it more than I do, but I read about it once. How the whole auto industry ruined the mass transit that was going to be in L.A. They had all the bus routes, and what were they going to have? They was going to have a trolley system. And then
tore up the tracks.
They tore you up.
They had a fantastic trolley system in L.A. And the oil companies and automobile manufacturers post-World War II said, you know, we need to sell as many cars as possible, so let's buy this up and rip it up for scrap.
Right. Exactly.
It's amazing. But your book is quite optimistic. In fact, in one sense, I'm trying to think of, you know, the other 9/11 truth novels I've read, and they – overall, although there are some kind of weird exceptions, like with these little twists and turns that may be a little bit more positive at the end if you really figure out what's going on. But the basic template, if you're doing a 9/11 truth novel, is usually the hero or whoever, heroine, the good guy or gal, figures it out and, you know, goes up against the evil powers that be that turn out to be practically omnipotent and omniscient. And so it's like a hopeless, tragic situation. That's usually the general template for these things. And your novel takes it in this totally opposite direction, in a sense, by, you know, taking it back to Malvern. And this, you can do it. If you can dream it, you can do it, which is a good message for the truth movement. I think that part of how 9/11 has worked on us is to convince us that these guys that did it are omnipotent and omniscient. You just can't possibly go up against them. They've got it all under control. You know, they're listening to your radio show right now and writing down every word you say. You know, how could you possibly ever dream of going up against them? So it's a disempowering kind of psyop that was done in the way it was, and perhaps even intentionally revealed more or less in the way it has been, to disempower us. And so I find your book cool in the way that it totally doesn't buy that. It's actually very empowering.
Well, I that's great to hear. Another thing, you're right about what we're up against, but another part which works in conjunction and makes it almost near impossible. I gave this book to a guy who's an editor, and he's a very successful editor, and actually I was about to email him because I hadn't heard from him in like 2 weeks, and he finally got back in touch. He said, I've been thinking about your book for the last couple of weeks, it's done this, it's done that. And he made the comment that he found the 9/11 stuff repugnant. And I couldn't, but this is a smart guy, and I couldn't believe he chose that word.
Well, of course, it is, the truth is quite repugnant, but it's
he meant the whole idea.
Yeah, he meant that you're repugnant for saying these terrible things.
Right, and it shocked me. And I thought, wow, if Alan's saying that, I got a lot tougher road to hoe. He's not the only one. The guy who's largely the model for Andy in the book is a dear friend of mine, very smart again. And he just finds it inconceivable that anything other than a day of bad coincidences happened on 9/11. It's people are just, you know, you can want to take it back. You take it back to the Pledge of Allegiance. It's just this day, this daily mantra that my country right or wrong.
There are a lot of crazy coincidence theorists out there.
Well, yeah, but I don't know what's going to happen. I actually think at this point, you know, as every day that goes by, we're less likely to ever, you know, break the story.
Well, you know, and we could be, you know, still being hit with some pretty major deceptions. It kind of looks that way to me anyway. I've been following these more recent false flag operations, the Paris attacks of 2015, San Bernardino, Orlando of last June. You know, I've got these three books out, collections of essays about those books. People can find out about that at falseflagtrilogy.blogspot.com. Anyway, it's obvious to me that the guys that did 9/11 are still hard at work, and that the main purpose of this is to keep the politics of fear going through Islamophobia, to keep, you know, Islam as replacing the lost communist enemy of the Cold War, to justify big military budgets, to justify Israeli expansionism, to justify wars to destroy the enemies of Israel over in that neighborhood. It's still going on. And, you know, I kind of think that 11-9, the, you know, election aftermath that we just witnessed, is perhaps another 9-11. That is, you know, I was just talking about this with Gordon Duff, that it sure looks like we just saw another massively fraudulent election on the scale of 2004, maybe even larger scale, that as many as 15 million Democratic ballots just totally disappeared, fell off the face of the earth. The exit polls versus results were 5 points plus for Trump in the key swing states, which is statistically, mathematically completely impossible. And we had Trump warning the nation that he wasn't going to respect the election results because the fix was in, it was going to be fraudulent. Well, of course, that's a perfect thing to say. Then the other side says, oh, talking like that makes you a crazy conspiracy theorist. And now they can't talk like that. And it's all sewn up. And historically, this makes perfect sense because the Warren Buffett and his Republican mob own the voting machines. There's never been a single case that we know of Democrats using rigged voting machines to steal elections, with a possible exception of Hillary stealing it from Bernie. But that probably was the same mob that just stole the election for Trump that put Hillary in there to make sure she would be an easier opponent. So essentially, we've had this same mob, which is tied in with the folks that did 9/11, running our black box voting machines for the last 15, 20 years. And, you know, we're still in this. And so your friend who can't even wrap his mind around 9/11, you know, something that happened 15 years ago, he's being flummoxed, bamboozled, and brainwashed, you know, every time he looks at the mainstream media, every time a major event happens. And this Trump coup d'etat that we just witnessed, you know, Gordon Duff was telling me in a private conversation, not on the air, that, you know, we're going to be lucky to be alive 2 years from now. It's looking pretty bad.
He could be right. He could absolutely. Well, regarding the whole Trump election, what you say is, I believe in all that. I mean, I believe in the plausibility and possibility of all that. However, I think what happened really is exactly what we think happened. I think this was a total anti-elite vote. I think the media just had its head so far in the sand. And what I would use to support that is that, you know, up until 2 days ago, you had the entire Democratic Party, you had Barack Obama saying these awful things about Donald Trump, and then virtually overnight, and Obama kind of gave away the store when he said, it's all about, this is like a varsity scrimmage, meaning, you know, he meant we're all in the same country, but the way I took it was, no, it's the same total racket. It doesn't matter whether it's Democrat or Republican, you're still going to get the shaft. And the way this, you know, Sanders is now saying he's ready to work with Trump, Clinton, Wall Street rebounded, the biggest day they've had in years. So I it could have been planned. I just think they just changed their tune very, very quickly and said, okay, well, we can work with Trump. And there was a story. I mean, I dread thinking about the coverage we're going to get from the New York Times in the next 4 years. Pretty much what we've seen for the last 6 months and a year. But there was a story just put online a couple of hours ago that he's already hitting up the lobbyists to fill his cabinet position. So it's going to be more of the same, just like it was more of the same, you know, within days of Barack Obama assuming
the presidency. Pretty much in the broad sweep of things, I think that's probably correct. But I think we do have to remember that there are kind of different, you know, sub-cliques. There's this book by, what's the guy's name? Is it Friedman? There's a book out on this new sort of global elite that I've been, you know, poking into. The author fancies himself an heir to C. Wright Mills, who wrote The Power Elite back in about 1960 or so, looking at, you know, how these elite power networks work. And I think they're not like one club that has a, you know, a director and a board of directors, and it's all totally organized. It's kind of these, you know, clusters of people that kind of brush elbows with each other. And if they're in the same branch or the same business, then they really know each other and really work together. But, you know, sort of the, you know, people on one side brush elbows with people on the other side, but may not actually be plugged in and working together. So within the sort of, yes, the national security community, there are different schools of thought, and different cliques and gangs. And there's this kind of extreme neocon Zionist gang that's clustered around the Likud Party of Israel and its American assets, and has links to some of the major elements of organized crime, going back, you know, the Meyer Lansky mob here, the Russian mob, which is all Jewish Zionist oligarchs over in Russia. And so these folks are the folks that did 9/11. Obama didn't do 9/11. Clinton didn't do 9/11. None of those people did. There was a very small number of people that did it, but it was behind it is this particular wing of the global power elite that I just described. And those people have not really been as in power, you know, under Obama. They're still there, and they're still playing their games and laying their traps and stuff. The Ukraine was a big trap that they laid, as Duff explained on the previous hour. But the bottom line here is that these are the people that just installed Trump, and Trump is going to install them. Trump is clearly installing a cabinet of neocons, which totally gives the lie to all of this rhetoric that he was going to be somehow different and pull back from NATO and you know, all of this stuff. People who hoped he was going to be a peace guy, he just put in the people that did 9/11 in order to double the military budget and launch endless wars of aggression. And we're very likely to see another 9/11, possibly a bigger one, possibly multiple ones, in order to achieve the objectives that these people have set for themselves.
Well, I don't doubt that. So, but is your position that his whole "why don't we get along with Putin and Russia" is that was just a facade?
No, that was as Duff explained in the first hour, that was organized by Netanyahu and his people. Newland, whose real name is Noodleman, she's, as Gordon said, the wife of the Kagan brothers, she's the one who funneled $5 billion to overthrow the government of Ukraine. And who's she working for? Not Obama, she's working for Netanyahu. The reason they did this was to force Putin up against the wall into grabbing Crimea, because he had no choice. He has to keep that Black Sea port. And so this was all predictable. It was all orchestrated for that purpose. Now Putin's grabbed Crimea, which is technically, you know, aggression and blah, blah, blah. So Obama, forced into the corner, has to slap sanctions on Russia. So now we have all of this, you know, problem. The problem with Russia gets a lot more tense. And now the Israelis, I wouldn't call it, it's not the whole country, it's Bibi's gang, works with their assets, and they approach the Russians. And the Russians apparently have pretty good hacking capabilities, and or they're being used as front men for this election theft. So the whole thing is a big game. It's part of the Likud Party's world takeover attempt, and they've just installed their man, their puppet, on the throne in the White House.
Well, that's I didn't know how much Trump was a free agent and how much he was part.
No, he's a mafia front man. He got his job. His first business, that gambling business, he took over from a Meyer Lansky mob CIA person. It had been used as a CIA and organized crime front before him, and he continued that basically. He has been a front man for the Meyer Lansky mob, which is the so-called Jewish mob here in America that's tied into the certain elements in Israel and elsewhere. That's been his role. That's all he's ever done.
They call it the Meyer Lansky mob,
his mentor
back to Meyer Lansky.
No, it's like this is not classified information. But the mainstream media, you know, like the New York Times, publishes it once and then it goes away. They're not telling you this because they were orchestrating Trump's rise. The Meyer Lansky man who was Trump's mentor was Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn.
That I know.
Yeah. Roy Cohn was the world's sleaziest criminal. So Cohn basically mentored Trump, set Trump up with this gambling business, which is Meyer Lansky. And that's all Trump has ever done. He parlayed his start into what he is today. So he's been a front man for this mob forever. That's his job. That's all he's ever done. And now he's fronting for essentially the same mob, which is, you know, elements of it tied in with Bibi Netanyahu. And they just took over the White House. So they're going to get what they want, whether in Syria, Iran, or what have you.
Well, if that is all true, then what I think we're looking at right here as we speak is pretty much the end game.
Absolutely. And they're going to destroy the United States, because as Sheikh Imran Hossein has said very eloquently, and many, many other people have noticed, that 9/11 was the event that ended the U.S. empire and inaugurated the Israeli empire, which is now the world's dominant empire. The British empire ruled the waves through the 19th century. The American empire took over in the mid to late 20th century. And on September 11, 2001, the Likudniks blew up the Trade Center, staged a Zionist coup d'etat in the United States, and seized global power. And we just saw 11-9 installing their mob figure, Trump, in the White House. They've cemented that global power.
Well, it's an interesting scenario.
It's probably the truth, unfortunately.
Well, if that is the case, then we really are seeing, I mean, the end game is almost a done deal.
They may very well want to take down the U.S. in orchestrated conflict, and
that's for sure. I said to somebody in a letter, this was, I guess this was Iraq. It reminded me of a game of hearts when somebody decides to shoot the moon. When, if you remember how hearts is played, and you start a game by passing three cards to the left, or the right, whatever it is, and these are supposed to be the cards you want to get rid of. But there always comes a time in a game of hearts where everybody knows somebody's trying to shoot the moon because they just took four hearts they could have not taken. And when we decided to invade Iraq, to me, that was the United States telling the world that we're shooting the moon. We don't care what the UN is saying. We don't care what this is, or what the evidence is or is not, we're shooting the moon. And I think what has happened since then with the Ukraine is pretty much borne that out. As to who's ultimately pulling all these strings, it's beyond me to figure all that out. I'll be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But I'm open to any suggestion.
Yeah, no, I think the moon shooting element is this Likudnik Zionist extremist neocon element that did 9/11. You know, the PNAC people, the people around Netanyahu, the organized crime connection to this is largely through the Bronfman family up in Canada. But to some extent through a sort of a network of Jewish Zionist global oligarchs. We all know that 7 out of the 8 oligarchs that took over almost all of the wealth of Russia when they privatized it after the fall of communism were Jewish Zionist dual citizens. And so this is essentially this kind of mob that has arisen to replace actual governance. So, you know, we now have a kind of a global criminal kleptocracy, and these people are at the apex of it. I think we're really in for a rough ride here in the next few years. I'm not really sure precisely what their strategy is going to be to try to continue expanding. But, you know, one thing that we've all been looking at for quite some time, those of us who are paying attention to what's happening over in Palestine, is that Bibi and his friends and these even more insane people around him, like Lieberman and so on, they are absolutely dedicated to finishing the genocide. That is, by killing or expelling all of the non-Jews that are there in occupied Palestine. They've got a demographic problem, and this is how they have to solve it. So the only way that can happen is under the fog of war. They need a really big war so they can do, you know, after 9/11, they had the cover that allowed them to assassinate Yasser Arafat, assassinate other key people, crush Palestinians, murder hundreds and hundreds of them, unleash their snipers on the Palestinian kids, all that stuff. They were able to do that thanks to 9/11. But they need something even bigger that starts a bigger Mideast conflagration so they can complete their genocide. That's really, I think, probably the main item on the agenda. And to do that, war, bigger war with Syria and Iran would be pretty much what the doctor ordered. They've been pushing for war with Iran forever. They almost got it. It was only a pushback from, you know, non-mobbed up military people that stopped it. But now with Trump in power, and Trump, you know, has publicly said that the only reason he went into politics was his opposition to the Iran nuclear deal. And of course, what that means is that he wants that Dick Cheney, you know, this Netanyahu, Wolfowitz, Richard Perle war on Iran. So that's really what he's in there for, I think. So I think this is what's going to happen. To make it happen, they need a huge false flag. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw, you know, Trump Tower and the Sears Tower go up simultaneously, along with a couple of nuclear explosions in American cities. It's going to be blamed on radical Muslims, as always. Trump will make sure that there are extreme, serious official measures against the Muslim community here, which may make what Hitler did to Jews in Germany look pretty tame. And then we'll see a huge war in the Middle East, which Israel will use to finish its ethnic cleansing and grab a lot more territory, maybe all the way out to the Nile and the Euphrates, which they've basically already taken through destroying, poisoning, balkanizing that region.
Well, I don't know that Trump, I wouldn't even give Trump credit for knowing what the Iran agreement says. I don't think he's serious enough
political. No, he knows what somebody whispered in his ear.
Okay, all right. But I disagree with you here. I don't think another 9/11 is necessary. I think that the one that was 15 years ago is going to last for a very long time. I think the people that elected Trump have gotten, they've got so many of their own troubles and problems to worry about, that they're not going to be reading anything between the lines of the New York Times. Let me just give you an example of the New York Times that did, because my area of expertise is mostly, if getting back to Malvern for a second, Rob's an out of work journalist, and as you know, out of work journalists are the best because nobody will hire them.
They're almost a kind of a redundant expression. If you're a real journalist, you're automatically out of work.
Yeah, exactly. This was during the Snowden thing, and there was a headline in the New York Times, and it said, quote, "Defiant Russia offers Snowden temporary asylum." Now, as recently as 20 years ago, the headline in the New York Times would have been, "Russia offers Snowden temporary asylum," because that's what the news was. You would never have seen "Defiant" put in the headline. They would have only saved that for some kind of a news analysis. But here you were actually getting it in the headline. And what makes that so noteworthy is that only the week before, Obama had forced down, I think it was the Bolivian president's plane, I think it was forced down in Switzerland, if I'm not, maybe Austria, I don't know. This is the kind of stuff that used to lead to wars between two countries, because he had information that Snowden was on board the plane. I'm sure you remember this.
Oh, yeah.
So by Russia offering Snowden asylum, they not only had the right to offer Snowden asylum, they had the obligation to offer him asylum based on the United States' very own actions, and yet the New York Times is calling Russia defiant in the headline. With that type of media cooperation and complicity, I don't think there's anything, we don't need another 9/11.
We don't.
Let's take this a little further. I had it, and this didn't even make the book. I had this idea, and funny enough, Kevin, I got this from watching Chinatown. It's that scene where Jake Gittes is about to follow Evelyn Mulry, so he goes out to her driveway and kicks off the taillight of her car, exposing the white bulb, so now he can follow the road down the highway more easily. And it occurred to me, I said, you know, every profession must have things like that, that after 20, 30 years on the job, you learn. Wouldn't a show be interesting that you just get these professionals on and that you could do doorman, you can do bartender, you could do private detectives? And I went out and I interviewed a bunch of people and I put this tape together and I tried to sell it to PBS stations. But one of the guys I interviewed was an architect, and very smart guy. And he said to me, he said, you know, people don't understand, when you walk into a building, that building was designed a certain way, you know, and that's how architects see the world. They go into a supermarket and they think, you know, well, what they put the produce over here for? The cold air is going to, my neighbor was this guy in Savannah, Henry. It was your typical southern backyard, which I meant there was no grass, but there were four wrecks of cars. There were these, all these muscle cars, and I mean wrecks. He bought these wrecks for, you know, he took them out of somebody's driveway. What he would do with these cars in 6 months, I mean literally showroom quality. He fixed them up, and he brought them to these, and he sold them. That's what he did in his spare time. Henry wasn't going in and telling his wife, Cheryl, did you see how the New York Times said Russia was defiant? But neither is the very smart Mr. Fernandez, the architect. The number of people who read Defiant Russia offers is such a minuscule number of people who, it is people like me who are journalists, who are fired from their jobs, who can't get other jobs. If that tiny sliver of people is aware, and even I, Kevin, even I don't catch all the tricks that the media plays. If such a tiny sliver is aware of all the games that the media plays, you don't need another 9/11.
It depends what you're trying to accomplish. If you're trying to basically keep moving slowly towards having, you know, prolonging the unipolar moment as long as possible and imposing our values on the world to the extent that we can before the rest of the world outgrows us, which is what Brzezinski says is the West's mission in his book, The Grand Chessboard, then right. Sure, you don't need another 9/11. But if your mission is to provoke a massive cataclysmic war in order to expand the borders of Israel from wherever they are now, which nobody knows because they're undeclared, to something much, much, much greater, and to completely eliminate the, you know, 5 million plus Palestinians living in this territory, actually a lot more than that if you're going out for the Nile to the Euphrates. This is a huge, I mean, even just taking over Palestine in the first place was an incredible project. Think of it. This very small group of people organizing to cross the ocean and take over this land that's holy to 4 billion people. And you've got like a handful of millions who are able to organize this, you know, God promised us this in our mythology thousands and thousands of years ago, so we're going to go eliminate the current inhabitants and take this place over and set up our own ethnic superiority state there. This is something no group could ever accomplish without amazing means. And so that in itself was required incredible orchestrations of things like the two world wars, for example, which there would be no such thing as Israel without those two world wars. Well, now, if you want to keep that going and expanding in a big way, and your specific goal is to get rid of, you know, 5 to 8 million, maybe 5 to 10 million people around Palestine. Those are just the Palestinians, and empty out these parts of Syria and Iraq, maybe Lebanon, you know, on their borders. Well, you know, that's a huge order. And how are you going to do that? You do need a 9/11. You need a bunch of 9/11s. And they've given us a bunch of 9/11s. They gave us the original. They gave us a whole bunch of follow-ups. London, Madrid, Bali, 7-7, and the 2015 Paris attacks, and on through Orlando. Dozens of these 9/11s. And they have had to in order to keep the pot boiling, keep the fear factor going, keep the Islamophobia going, keep the atmosphere such so they can continue to move towards their final objectives, which do involve this massive Middle East war, very likely nuclear, under which a mushroom cloud of fog of war will cover the whole region, and then they can finish that genocide. And if you want to accomplish that, you do need another 9/11. Actually, you need something much bigger.
Well, I'm not looking forward to that.
I'm not either, but that's what they're planning. I
got to say, I'm not sure you're right there, because I'm gonna liken it back to my heart's analogy. This has been going on now for 50 years, and with all the wars that you mentioned, at the end of a hearts game, when the game has been already determined, but you still play out the hand, in effect, you could call the election of Donald Trump just playing out the hands, you know. It does, whether it was, you know, whether it was Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, you're not, from what you're describing, you're not going to really see much of a difference in how things are done. I mean, if Hillary Clinton is going to be pushing for a no-fly zone in Syria against a Russian army that has been invited to Syria when the United States has not been invited to Syria. Well, that could, there could be your nuclear war there. You know, Trump might have his other way. You know, I just still say that this is all part of just playing out the hands. I don't see that, I don't see anything major. I think it's more a whimper than a bomb. I really do.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, I think it, at some level.
It's going to be, it's going to be the death of a thousand cuts. I mean, you know, it's gotten even worse. I mean, the Clinton didn't want the word occupation in the Democratic platform. You would think that maybe it's at some point that the occupation would end. It's clearly, not only is it not ending, it has every indication of succeeding in its entirety, and it was done over 50 years. It wasn't done over, you know, a year. I think it's just going to keep rolling merrily along, and with the media involved, no, I just see it. Anything big is forecast, unless we're talking about the only major war I see is with Russia, and I do see that minimized with Trump in office. I do not see war with Russia happening now. That's the one good thing I see with the Trump election. I unless that was all nonsense too.
I think it probably was at least partly staged or has been, but. Again, you know, from a U.S. perspective, you know, that if, you know, we're basically struggling for some definition of the American national interest, then, you know, obviously we're looking out for ourselves against everybody else, but our main competitors in the world would be Russia and China, especially China, and maybe to some extent India and the BRICS powers, right? And so that's what we would be kind of looking out against. But instead, what's happened since 9/11, and I think will continue to happen through the continuing series of 9/11s or post 9/11 follow-up false flags, is to divert the U.S. towards the enemies of Israel, that is Muslims. And this is not in the interest of the U.S. whatsoever, quite the opposite. It would be in the interest of U.S. to basically team up with the Islamic world and build a more powerful Islamic world as a counterweight to some of these other forces. So that's, I think, the reason this Russia thing has been pushed out of control. And I would agree with Duff. It's probably been pushed out of control by the Zionists who've basically been playing us, especially since 9/11.
Well,
I mean, who are the Newlands, right? I mean, who the Kagans, who actually did the Ukraine thing that caused the whole problem?
Well, now you're not, because I know who you're referring to. It's funny because I remember, and this is the way it works in Washington. I remember a column that David Brooks wrote. This is so Brooksian. The sentence had something along the lines of, I heard Victoria Nuland one night talk on Russia, and she dazzled. Brooks says, well, of course he didn't mention in his column that he heard her in her living room, you know, where he'd been invited over for dinner. But let me ask you, you think Victoria Nuland was acting as a free agent and all of that?
No, but she was acting as an Israeli agent.
But I mean, as far as her involvement with the United States government. I mean,
right, that's her cover job. Like so many other CNM and other paid and or unpaid Israeli agents, her cover job is with the U.S. State Department.
But somebody must have known what she was up. Like before she got appointed to this position, the Undersecretary of State or whatever. I mean, that the $5 billion, because I remember her boasting about that. That was spent before she came on board, correct?
I'm not entirely sure when it was spent, how it was spent, who funneled the money, but I can tell you who was behind that policy, and that was this neocon team that she's
part of. I don't doubt that at all. But she, when she was caught on tape saying Yax is our guy, and he's out, by the way, now, isn't he?
Think so, yeah.
Yeah. When she was saying Yax is our guy, whoever, she was new on the job. That was a month after she had taken her position, as I recall. So this was all in the works long before, I don't know how long before, but but it was certainly before she got that
post. Well, yeah, but that's why part of the reason they put her over there was to run this.
So she might have been an under secretary.
Yeah, and I'm not saying she's the whole, you know, the only one involved in any of this.
But that's more to my point, Kevin, that you know, it's out there that we did. I mean, who knows what we read anywhere is true. But let's just assume it is true that Gorbachev was promised that NATO would not expand east. The information that NATO is doing exercises on Russia's doorstep, that the Beatles, you know, back in the USSR. And by the way, they talk about the Beatles. People don't remember that. Not only did they have a song back in the USSR, they actually led the White Album with Back in the USSR. That was 1969 when Russia was still the enemy and the Beatles. And not only that, they had that very provocative line, back in the U.S., back in the U.S.
Well, they were parodying the Beach Boys back in the USA.
But it's just interesting that they stepped up to do that. But even in that song, you know, the Ukraine girls really knocked me out. They leave the West behind. My point is, all of this information of that the United States and NATO were clearly the provocateurs here, obviously. And Putin, what Putin was doing, he was basically playing black in a chess match and playing it brilliantly. The fact that that's all out there and the media is still allowed to get away with this narrative of how the NATO and the United States has to restrain Putin, it speaks to an inability of critical thought on the part of so many millions of Americans that they can be. All the goals here can be achieved through lying and just doing these little things without any more 9/11s. I mean, what went on in the Ukraine is absolutely huge. The fact, or let's go to Iran. Iran didn't threaten the United States. Didn't have the ability to threaten the United States. It hasn't been taking land from its neighbors. Yet the entire narrative in the American media was that Iran has to be contained. And Americans almost overwhelmingly bought into that narrative too. If I can make a comparison, because this is how it works, and I don't need to tell you this, but this is such an important point. The American people are often called, you know, cattle. Nowhere is that more true than in the sense of a cattle drive. And you have millions of Americans are the cattle, and as you remember your cowboy movies, it takes very few cowboys to control a cattle drive.
Well, yeah, and if they have to turn the whole herd at once, they can say, you know, fire a gunshot, bang,
exactly,
and they all turn. That's what 9/11 was.
Exactly right, and not only that, the herd doesn't even know it's been moved. And a perfect example of that, two things that happened at the same time. One was the Iran thing, and the second thing was the warming of relations with Cuba. And overwhelmingly, the words for Cuba were positive, democracy, hopeful, improvement, all these positive words.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
It's
scripted. It's like the Ministry of Information is telling the New York Times how to write these things.
Exactly right. And the people don't even know that they're being moved, but they're all going. And if a few cattle stray away, who the hell cares?
Well, now, they're the ones listening to Truth Jihad Radio, the stray cattle.
Well, you bring that up. Okay.
Yeah. My audience consists almost entirely of cattle who've wandered away from the herd and started trying to see what's really going on.
Exactly. Well, and we're not much of the herd. we don't count in the final tally in the stockade. But of course, to continue with the analogy, the thing that every cowboy fears most is a stampede. Just something. And just like in Tunisia, that was a stampede. Now, if that's a true story, as I recall, that is one movement, maybe the only one in the last 100 years, that has really taken hold. From what I've read, Tunisia is now a functioning democracy. But that really
that was the success story of the Arab Spring, more or less, so far. I mean, it's not perfect. They, the nasty deep state secularist forces played dirty tricks on the peaceful democratic Islamists there in order to force them out. But then they went out peacefully, and everybody's relatively happy. So, yeah, it's all right. Anyway, we hit the end of the hour.
That did start with a street vendor, did it not?
Yeah, it did. And so maybe we should have a stampede here in the United States.
That's what we're waiting for.
But we're going to have to wait till the next show to get the details out on that one. Well, thank you, Nick Bam, author of Malvern. I'll put up a link to that.
Thank you.